Well, welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection, ladies and gentlemen. And again, hey, we're still in February, a little bit of snow on the ground, but hey, we're going to continue on. Well, we'd like to welcome Dr. Bart Billings to the show today, and along with Ray, we're going to have a discussion on PTSD. Dr. Billings has come out with a brand new book called Invisible Scars, How to Treat Combat Stress and PTSD Without Medication. Bart, welcome to Warrior Connection, sir.
Oh, thank you very much.
Sure, I'm glad to have you back, sir.
Well,
I mean, you've got a distinguished career. You were in the U.S. Army, sir, and you're a retired colonel, and then you went back in a civilian environment working in psychology and all of this stuff to try and help individuals get out of PTSD problems. How did you decide to do this, sir?
Well, actually, I put 34 years in active and reserve, and in the 70s, when I was at Tripler Hospital, teaching a workshop on reality therapy, choice theory, psychology, they asked me to meet with a veterans group, and it was a group of individuals that they called Vietnam Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. And so I said, you know, fine, you know, I joined the group and talked with the people. And the realization I had then was that the people who were being diagnosed with a disorder really didn't have a disorder. What they had was a normal reaction from being in combat. In other words, they had post-traumatic stress. And the more and more I talked with people, the more I realized that 99% of the people that are in combat have a degree of post-traumatic stress. It only becomes a disorder if they're not able to figure out how to get back to normal, which has occurred more often in prior wars. In World War II, they called it battle fatigue. And the people who were diagnosed with battle fatigue had a lot of time before their combat experiences and return to the community occurred. So over that period of time, they figured things out, and they figured out what was normal, what was not normal. And none of them were released into the community with a disorder. They were released. Nobody was diagnosed in World War II as battle fatigue disorder. It was battle fatigue. They were tired from fighting. And so I concluded at Tripler that basically that's the same kind of thing that was happening in Vietnam, but now they were being called individuals having a disorder. And so I continued the work with people from the 70s and spent 40 years developing my perceptions. And in the early 90s, when I was a hospital commanding officer in a reserve hospital unit, when everybody was deployed all over the world, when they came back a year later, there were all kind of problems. And that's when I, again, reinforced what I was thinking, and we put together a program, the International Combat Stress Conference at that time, to really get into taking a hard look at what happens to people when they go to combat, what happens in combat, prior to combat, and when they get back. And that Combat Stress Conference is the longest-running conference in the world. It's still going, and I run it as a volunteer civilian, and we're going to do 23 years this May. So, you know, I kind of got dragged into it because when I initially went into the military, I was initially trained as a combat engineer, even some time as a drill instructor, and then when they realized I had the education I had because I got pulled out of a graduate program, I got a direct commission. So my whole experience has been trying to help people, even when I was enlisted, do better, you know, function better. I was a trainer as a combat engineer. I was a trainer as a DI, and for years, for 40 years, I've been trying to develop programs and come up with a conclusion on how to best deal with combat stress. And when it becomes a deterrent to somebody's life, combat stress disorder. But that's kind of a little bit of history of how I got into it. I've been asked for many, many years to write a book based on my observations, based on the 22 years of running the Combat Stress Conference, and that's how the book came about. So the whole purpose of the book, Invisible Scars, is to save lives.
Let me jump in.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, I know the stories we have when our fathers all went to World War II and came back, and they told the stories of how they came back. They had long time to readjust and calm down and everything back because they're coming back on ships and everything.
Right.
That was quite a difference. I know when I came back from Vietnam both times, I basically was pulled out of combat, put on an airplane, and I was back home within 24 hours.
Yeah, that's a big problem. I interviewed in the book, let me give you an example of the difference. A pilot, Army Air Corps, and I don't know if you know this, but there were more casualties in the Army Air Corps than there were in the Marines or the Navy in World War II. So there were tremendous losses. And he experienced a lot of tragedy, and he's 94 years old, and when I interviewed him, last year, I asked him, how did you and your crew deal with losing people every time you went up, people getting completely blown out of the sky next to you? And he said, on our first mission, my whole crew were atheists. And when we landed, they were all Christians. He said, we even had Jewish guys saying the Hail Mary. So they did a lot of praying, a lot of talking before the missions. And when they finished their 33 missions in Romania, that was very, very bad, bad conditions where they were flying, because they flew to get rid of the oil fields that the Germans were using for their fuel supplies. And that they had to fly through the Alps because their plane couldn't get over them. They couldn't get that altitude. And they basically... I had a hand-drawn map on how to get through the Alps, and then they dropped their bombs, and they were fired upon by anti-aircraft and Messerschmitts. The German Air Force came up after them, and they completed 33 missions and made it back and got relieved because they did their tour. But they were sent back to North Carolina for 3 months, he told me. And when I asked, what did they do in 3 months? Because here's a crew that, like he said, we had combat stress on steroids. He said they spent 3 months there, and they did not get medicated. But what they did is there was a Catholic priest there. And he said that made the biggest difference because they had somebody to talk to. Now, didn't, as far as I'm concerned, it could have been any kind of person who was going to spend time with them, could have been any religion, but it just so happened there was a Catholic priest, and they all did fine, and they returned to their homes. He returned to combat. He flew another 11 missions in B-17s out of England, and this time he flew over France and Germany, and then he went on to fly in the Korean War and in the Vietnam War and Strategic Air Command. And he's the nicest, easiest-going guy you're going to meet, because he realized, they had the time to switch over and to learn how to be normal, to talk, somebody that cared about them. Right now, they don't get 3 months. They don't even get 3 days for the most part. They're back, and they're assigned to their unit, and they might get a week off or so. But they're really not discussing the issue. And in the book, I talked about what an ideal transition program could easily be set up. We have the staff. We have the expertise. That would give them the time. I mean, it took them 6 to 9 months to train me to be a combat engineer, but it should take at least a few months to train me to get back to the civilian community, and that's not happening.
I found it so very interesting, because when I look at this and look at myself, and Ray, you're right there too, and we've had these conversations, and you've been in there. I don't think that what they call PTSD is any type of a psychological condition whatsoever. Like you said, it's a normal reaction. What's
PTS,
happened when we've gone to war.
Just say PTS. It's not a D. Get rid of the D. PTS
exactly.
Is a normal reaction to being in an abnormal environment.
the thing that gets me, and what we've had the hardest thing for me, and I think where it's everybody else, it's more of a moral injury deep in the soul, to where you have to reconnect with God, you have to reconnect with your family, you have to reconnect with your civilian world. And as Ray has said over and over again, and showed up there, when you're in the military, you got two families. But when you're in combat, you can only deal with your military family.
That's correct.
And when you're a civilian, you can only deal with your civilian family. But when you're caught in that limbo between the two, and I think the perfect example of the individual historically and now that's in the news all over is Chris Kyle. I mean, he was caught in that trap where he couldn't get in, you know, out of one or into the other, into one and out of the other, and he was just, I mean, that's a real evident one, I mean, in the news and everybody that everybody can see, caught in that trap where you can't go either direction. How can we get out of that trap?
I talk about Chris Kyle in the book. And Chris Kyle came back, and he went to the VA, and he felt he was doing something very productive. He was going to help veterans make the readjustment, getting back into the community, help them with the rehab. What went wrong there is when he was, and I state this very clearly in the book, when he was in the groups at the VA, and the therapists running these groups knew fully that he was taking people out to the shooting range as part of the rehabilitation. If I was running that group, I would have said, no, you don't do that. You don't take people who are on brain-altering medications to a shooting range. They can shoot somebody or themselves. You take and teach them how to play golf or tennis or something else. But you don't do that. And sure enough, what happened is he did wind up taking a guy to the shooting range who was messed up for a long time, not only on brain-altering psych meds, but on illegal substances. And he didn't know whether he was coming or going, that guy. When you're taking brain-altering meds, and basically all psychiatric meds are antidepressants, antipsychotics, they all have black box warnings. That's the most serious warning for side effects on any medication, black box. You see black box, you better say, whoa, watch out. Because the first adverse reaction in the black box warning for psychiatric meds, and he was on multiple psychiatric meds, the shooter, is suicidality, poor judgment and reasoning, anger and hostility. These are the first three side effects for people taking those types of medications. So when he went out to the range, it didn't surprise me when I heard his history of the meds that he was on, that he would do something that insane, if you want to call it that. But he was out of his brain, not out of his mind, because of the medications. And if you read the stories about the shooter, he was in and out of the VA. They medicate him. And that's really coming to the forefront now. So when they had his trial, it was like they were going to determine whether he was mentally ill at the time he shot Chris Kyle. Well, there was no mention that I heard of him having a toxic reaction to all of the psychiatric medications that resulted in this really strange, crazy behavior. And if you read the book by Dr. Peter Bregan, who is a psychiatrist, Medication Madness, the first chapter in that book talks about a guy who had no history of mental problems, went to his doctor, had a back problem. He saw the ads in the waiting room about Paxil. He said to the doctor, hey, I saw those ads about Paxil. I get depressed every once in a while. Do you think that's something that I should take? And instead of the doctor saying, well, everybody gets depressed once in a while, it's part of life, he gave him some. And within a very short period of time, here's a guy that never had any psychiatric problems, was contemplating killing himself and his wife. And what he planned on doing, talk about, his reasoning being shot from this medication, he was going to steal a shotgun out of the front seat of a police car and kill himself with it. Initially, he was going to kill his wife, too, but then he changed his mind, and he was just going to kill himself. He couldn't find the shotgun. Now, this guy never shot a gun in his life. So what did he do? He roamed around, and he saw a police officer giving a ticket. When the police officer got out of his car to return the driver's license to the person he stopped, this guy ran him down, broke his legs, and was trying to get his pistol and said, look, I'm not going to hurt you. I just want to kill myself. Well, they subdued him. They put him in jail. He wasn't taking any more antidepressants in jail. And he was saying, wait a minute, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would I do something like that? And he was, all charges were dropped. He had a toxic reaction to these medications. The police officer actually went to his house and told me, forgave him for what he did. He understand that he had this toxic reaction, that he didn't know what he was doing. That was never talked about during the Chris Kyle trial. Now, I'm not saying one way or the other that, you know, should he be found guilty or not, but at least they should have looked at, did he have a toxic reaction to these black box medications as well as the illegal substances he was taking? So, you know, so that's my take on the Chris Kyle story. Chris was doing a good job with his life and getting back to normal and going through the transition with his wife and his family, you know, and he was trying to meet his need for self-worth and by taking people out and helping them get back to normal with their rehabilitation, but he wasn't warned where to take them.
You know, it gets real scary because not only do we have the total prescription of psychiatric drugs, but then one of the other primary problems and diagnoses, as you're well aware, is fibromyalgia and all the neurological problems and all the neuromuscular problems.
Oh, absolutely.
So again, they're prescribing these medications, which have horrific, horrific black box effects, the same thing, because in a lot of cases, these are the same meds that are prescribed for psychological conditions that they have now said, well, let's give them okay for fibromyalgia or the other things. Since I know, I mean, we've heard the stories and I've seen it and verified the stories where individuals were had this stuff and they were putting on the Seroquel or the other drugs.
Yeah.
And next thing we know, well, hey, it's all over, buddy.
Now,
how do we put common sense back into it?
Well, the only way, you know, you got to stop and think about this. They are now, and they have been for, you know, since around 2002 or maybe even before, they are sending troops off to battle with 180 days worth of psychiatric medications. They are sending, I remember a Marine telling me the story, he said they were in Afghanistan and it was really cold and they had trouble sleeping at night because it was so cold. And they asked our headquarters, send us something to help us sleep. Well, what did they get next day in the truck? Did they get blankets? Did they get jackets? No. They got boxes of antipsychotic medication, Seroquel, to help them sleep. Now, can you believe that? That is outrageous, but these are true stories. And you got to stop and think, between 2005 and 2011, the purchases of psychiatric medications by DOD increased 700%. And when you say, why? Well, you stop and think, psychiatry and the pharmaceutical companies, just on psychiatric medications, generate $333 billion a year for their fees and the meds. $333 billion a year. So stop and take a hard look. Here's a medication, and there's no medications that work for PTS. The studies have shown that. I show them where the studies are in my book. They don't work. These drugs don't work, but their side effects are disastrous. Just about all of the mass shooters were on some type of psychiatric medications. That's tragic, and I list them in the book. I list a whole bunch of the mass shooters, who they were, and type of psychiatric meds they were on. Now, the way to stop it, how do you stop it? Well, there's a Marine who started this back in Pennsylvania about two, three years ago. He was given combinations of psychiatric meds from the local VA there. he wound up, he was a real hero in military. He won all kind of awards and medals, and he comes back, and he couldn't determine whether he was coming or going, went into the pharmacy, stole stuff. This wasn't his behavior. His reasoning and judgment was shot. So they realized he wasn't getting the treatment he needed to. He sued the VA back in Pennsylvania, Scranton, Pennsylvania, and he won $3.7 million. That's a breakthrough because they determined that the VA violated the standard of care. Now, what's going to happen? There was another suit I was an expert witness on in Arizona. It's still in the progress of being appealed. And this guy came out of the Air Force, and he had no PTS. He was pretty, maybe to a small degree, but it wasn't extreme. And by no way did he have a disorder, but he went to the VA like you should after 20 years, and he brought his records. And he had what's called vibroacoustic disease. He had GI problems. That's from flying so many hours in a high-intensity, low-frequency vibratory environment, which is the surveillance plane, electronic surveillance, that he flew for thousands of hours. The doctor told him he had PTSD. Started prescribing psych meds. Well, his whole life turned. He came out speaking a couple languages. He had a master's degree. He was teaching at two colleges, getting his doctorate. Within a very short period of time, he lost all of that. He was seen at that VA and medicated with numerous psychiatric meds for 15 years. 8 of those years, he was in a wheelchair. He couldn't even walk. And finally, he went to a private detox unit to detox off everything. 20 days later, he walked out of that unit. He walked out. He had slight Parkinsonian tremor in his right arm, and that went away eventually. These are the kinds of stories. There was a story here in San Diego. The inspector general for the VA came to San Diego because a Marine committed suicide locally. And they were forced by a service group and an attorney who was a retired Marine general to look into it. They looked into it. It was in the newspaper. It made the front page of the newspaper 2 weeks ago. They concluded that the VA in San Diego erred in several ways in treating this young Marine who killed himself. And I know what the medications were he was on. He was on narcotics and some psychiatric meds. And that's a perfect storm for suicide. And that's what happened to him. So, these... More and more is being exposed. In the back of my book, I have all the articles that talk about all these cases over the years, but nothing's being done. They're making the media to a certain degree, but nothing's being done. So what bottom line is, I think the only way anything's going to happen is the veterans who are experiencing this need to step up, need to obtain legal counsel, and need to go after the people who are not providing appropriate treatment. If these doctors were in the civilian community, they'd probably lose their license.
Ray, what are you finding at Camp Lejeune with the current kids?
Well,
I'm not familiar with Camp Lejeune. I live 15 minutes from Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
Well, I've been working at Camp Lejeune, Dr. Billings, and it's an honor to speak with you again and Dr. Roki, two of my favorite veteran workers that's trying to save these lives of these guys. But men and women I work with at Camp Lejeune, most of them have come out of Afghanistan or Iraq, and most of them are dealing with some type of trauma. And I would dare say 99% of them are on medications, and they're trying to heal them with those. But what I try to do is intervene in that, and I do it in a way that I did it. I was on a lot of medication, Dr. Billings, and they had me on 8 hydrocodone a day. They had me on Zoloft. Mm-hmm. They had me on Seroquel. And I was able over a year's time to get off of all those medications, because I know some people that they get off of it very quickly, and they're in a real position for suicide when they do those things, I think. But Camp Lejeune has got a high rate of suicide now, and we're dealing with it all the time.
Yeah, here's something to think about, and I mentioned this in the book. Like I said, these medications are brain-altering. I don't even say mind-altering, brain-altering. It's more scientific.
Right.
They alter your brain. They interfere with your thoughts and your reasoning. They suicidal thoughts, etc. Even if you haven't been in combat, I have a friend who I met at a wellness center conference, and we talked afterwards and several days after, and he was a heavyweight champion of the world, 2006. His name is Chris Bird. And he had an inflamed foot, and Chris was the nicest guy in the world. No history of any mental problems, beautiful family. And he went into the doctors with his inflamed foot, and they gave him an antidepressant so his foot wouldn't hurt. Now, what does that tell you? How powerful are these drugs when it stops pain from your extremity? I mean, and within a very short period of time, Chris was contemplating killing himself. He was very angry. He almost beat up one of his relatives. He never acted like that. Thank goodness his wife realized, she connected his behavior with the medication. I mean, there were times when his son had to stay home from high school on a suicide watch with him. And she said, you got to get off these medications. They're driving you crazy. And he got off them, and he went right back to normal. So the medications, whether you're in combat or not, have the same kinds of effects, probably even worse if you've been in combat. So it's imperative that people get into a detox program, gradually get off of them, and get into a program that has integrative treatment. And that basically is the treatment of choice. And in my book, I list 30 types of integrative treatment programs, anything from just plain counseling to yoga to Pilates to biofeedback, on and on and on. And you meet with the person, you develop a program that's tailored to their needs. If they need a nutritionist, if they have bad limbs and they can't do regular exercise, you get them into some kind of water aerobics. There's all kinds of ways to get back to normal. Jobs are very important. A decent job that's consistent with your ability and aptitude. All these things need to be looked at. But, you know, like I said, you see all these kids in Camp Lejeune. I was told by a social worker who did multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and other people come to my combat stress conference that one time or another 90% of the people in combat were on some type of psychiatric meds, even if it was antipsychotics just to sleep.
That is, I mean, it's frightening because then we have the other problem, and I've seen this over and over and over again from the Vietnam era through. In order to get rid of the pain that they don't want to deal with, they start self-medicating. So we end up with all of the street drugs and everything that are hidden. We got all of the alcohol abuse. It's incredibly out of control.
Yeah.
And then you combine that together with your pain medications, your all the narcotics and everything to control the incredible physiological damage and pain. And then they want to treat the PTSD and treat them with the psychotropic drugs, and it's just like, my God, it's a cocktail of death.
That's exactly right. That's what happened to the person who shot Chris Kyle. He was on all of those different kind of medications for an extended period of time. The VA situation here, I had to stop the presses on my book because it hit the newspaper right as my book was being printed, and I said, hang on. And I made that in the last chapter and pretty much the last paragraph in the book. And basically what I said is, okay, the VA IG proved this book to be accurate and what they just found here. And that's what I was talking about throughout most of the book, about, you know, the inappropriate treatment, the medications on the battlefield, the medication when they get home. I mean, it's very difficult if somebody comes back from combat and they're on psychiatric meds, or whether they're not coming back from combat, whether they just went through basic training and somebody decides that they need some help emotional and give them some drugs. It's really hard to do any kind of integrative treatment with somebody whose brain is altered. It's very difficult. I experienced that. I've been in mental health field 49 years, and I remember in my early years I was working and doing internships at state hospitals, and I concluded at that time, it's really hard working with these patients that are medicated. It's hard. You can't. It's very difficult to do therapy with them. I had an easier time doing therapy with people who are diagnosed as schizophrenic with all kind of weird behavior and maybe not on meds. but at that time it was hard to find those people. But you have to stop and think about it. It's very, very hard to work with somebody whose brain is altered by substances. They have to detox, and that's why detox is so very, a legitimate detoxification program with the vitamins, minerals, the medical supervision, and gradually get them off these meds while you're introducing other things into their system, as well as treatment programs. So, yeah,
Dr.
you're
Billy,
right.
I'm sorry. But I was jumping in there, but I'm sorry about that. But I wanted to ask you a question, too. Most of the people that I deal with are on medication, and I ask mm-hmm. them how many are married, and a lot of them do raise their hands. And then I'll ask them, yep. how's your marriage going? And we've got a high rate of suicide, and a lot of it came out of just marriages that are falling apart. And it seems as though those medications are desensitizing the person to the point they can't have normal relations with their spouse, which creates a whole nother atmosphere, you know, in the home, and irritability, fussing, just the whole deal. And they have to have that normal sexual contact with your spouse just to have a normal family. But the drugs are destroying marriages all the time. And I think the Vietnam veterans have a 90-some percent divorce rate. Gulf War veterans, which are the children of the Vietnam veterans, have a 90% divorce rate. And the men of today, they're following the same suit of their parents because of these drugs.
You're absolutely right. It's very, very difficult to communicate when you have something that's altering your brain. Very difficult. You know, like I said, your judgment and reasoning is impaired. And that's what you find. People on these type of medications have trouble communicating with another human being, having a real conversation, a real relationship. It's very difficult. It's almost like, you know, me telling you, take your best buddy out and you drink water and let him have about 5 or 6 shots of gin and you have a real conversation with him. It doesn't happen, does it?
No, it doesn't.
You don't even want to be around them, do you?
No. No, you don't.
And that's what's going on with these meds. The thing with alcohol is, you know, the next day that gets metabolized and, you know, gets out of the person's system. But with these drugs, it's there all the time.
The biggest problem, I think, and I'm going to put through another kink in here, and we're having this problem, an ongoing, nonstop problem, is the frustration with all the physiological injuries and illnesses all the veterans have from all this God-blessed toxic battlefield. And so they're physiologically, they're messed up, and they can't get proper medical care. So now you combine the physiological effects together with all this, the moral injury effects, and then you put together with the meds and the alcohol, and then they have no backup system.
No, it's a perfect storm for suicide, for violence. But, you know, let me tell you a story about what the government did in 1920. In 1920, and again, this is all covered in the book, in 1920, the government realized there were a lot of World War I vets wandering the streets with all kind of physical problems and psychological problems. So what they did is they passed the Smith-Vess Act. Smith-Vess Act was an act to provide rehabilitation services, physical and mental, so these people could wind up in meaningful employment. It's called the National Vocational Rehabilitation Act. That act was the beginning of every state in the country having a Department of Rehabilitation, which was funded for the most part by the federal government. Now, what grew out of that? Well, what grew out of that was especially of physical medicine and rehabilitation. And I know a lot about that because I was chief of physical medicine rehabilitation, chief of professional services at the medical school at UC Davis for several years. I ran PT, OT, speech, orthotics, prosthetics, psychosocial vocational services, and we had people with physical impairments, which also is accompanied just about all the time by emotional disturbances. I mean, if you're driving your car home and all of a sudden you get in an accident and 2 days later you're in the hospital and you can't walk anymore, I mean, it's a combination. So what happened, PM&R grew, and it was all through World War II. There were physical medicine rehab specialists. And these specialists, the people who ran PM&R in 1937, were recognized by the American Medical Association, a division by itself called physiatry. Physiatry is the Greek word, means physical physician. They are PM&R medical doctors who run it. What's happened lately is PM&R over the years has really lost a role. I mean, that profession was born of war. It was born of war. But they're doing meaningless things now, pretty much as far as I'm concerned. They're doing pain management. They're not doing what they initially grew out of. And the people who are seeing most of our vets now, whether you have traumatic brain injuries or physical injuries, are psychiatrists. And that's the last person. They are not trained. Matter of fact, at the medical school, the Department of Psychiatry was even afraid to come on our service because they didn't know how to deal with muscle diseases, burns, paraplegics, quadriplegics, head injuries. That's why we had to develop our own psychosocial vocational section, which were experts in these areas as well. So, you know, there's your answer. The answer is we have a lot of people with physiological problems. Now, they should be seeing a physiatrist, not a psychologist. And that physiatrist should be doing all of the things within their specialty, which is integrative treatment, integrative wellness, and work with these people without medicating them. There's your answer.
Dr. Billings, if someone's listening to this program today and they're on medications like I was at one time, how would you recommend they stop? Maybe their spouse is on these medications, or maybe they're on them, and I know you don't want them to quit automatically, but how do you recommend they get off of it?
I recommend that they look within their community or outside their community to find a detoxification program where they detoxify people out of medications, drugs, heavy metal, you know, lead, et cetera, mercury. But the detoxification programs are all over the country, and you go in for a period of time, and it's medically supervised. But you want to, at the same time, while you're going and detoxing, they should be affiliated with some type of integrative treatment program, whether it's, you know, therapy, biofeedback, you know, a comprehensive integrative treatment program. And that's the answer. Now, there's a program back in Maryland, and again, this is in the book, that I felt was one of the best in the country. So what I did is I got permission, and I reprinted what their whole program does. Their program is in Maryland. It's run by a retired Navy psychologist. They use absolutely no medications there. It's all integrative treatment. They will pay for any veteran in the United States to fly to their program. They will pick them up. They will spend a week with them, house them, work with them, no charge, and they will fly them back home, and they'll follow up with them. That is incredible.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you can look that up in the book. It's one of the chapters in the book of transitional programs. There's a program in San Diego that takes people for 3 weeks and teaches them to make the transition from the military and the civilian community. It's called Reboot. And that program deals with the transitional period and the psychological aspects, and then a week of learning how to identify kinds of jobs or training or education that you want to do. Both programs have a very high success rate. The program in San Diego, their success rate is like 94% in the local college did a follow-up for them. So it's incredible. There are good programs, and again, they're mentioned in the book, so I'm hoping people pick up the book. The book is about saving lives. It's about identifying. The book talks about identifying the problems, but it's not a book of just complaining, but it talks about solutions. And the transitional period that we talked about earlier in our conversation, I have something in there. Let me bounce this off you two guys. What I suggested is before a unit is returned from combat, you have a team of special operators, Navy SEALs, Green Berets, et cetera, Marine Recon, the Air Force, their special program, the PJ program in the Air Force, Parajumper, or the Pararescue. These are all special ops people. They're retired. You train them up on teaching people what's normal, what's not normal, how to make the transition. They go and they spend a week or two in the combat area with the unit that's ready to return. They have meetings with them as much as they can and talk about the transition. Then they fly back with them to the United States. They are on the base with them, the same unit. They stay with this unit. They have meetings once a day right after PT. They have their physical training. They have mental training units. So you got MT right after PT. They work with these people. They see how they're doing. They're talking about normalizing themselves, the kinds of things they should be doing. They spend a month with them. Then anybody who they feel hasn't made the transition yet, they refer to someone that will follow and work with them. That at least will be a month and a half of working on a transitional program. I spoke to special operators about this. I spoke to people in the military, and their comments were, wow, if we had that, we wouldn't see half of the problems we're seeing now. But nobody's doing it.
You know, when we came back, I know I remember the first one I came back to Vietnam, the first time we went over as a unit came back. Then I went the second time, went over as an individual, came back as an individual.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of different deployments, off and on, recalled active duty over 40-odd years, almost 40 years, period, 1967 to 1995. And each time we'd go and we'd come back as an individual.
Yeah, see,
and
that's
that
the
makes
problem.
It extraordinarily difficult because you don't have any continuity of anything.
No, and see, and again, I covered that in the book. In World War II, they went as units. But they started going as individuals in Korea and Vietnam, and that really wasn't a good idea. That really didn't work that well. It didn't work. And they really didn't learn their lesson. Like I said, when my hospital... General Hospital unit was deployed. They were deployed as individuals, and they trained every month. You know, there was a reserve hospital. They had a couple weeks a year, maybe more than a couple weeks, as a unit, and they were ready to deploy as a unit, and they said, nope, you're going to go to Kuwait. You're going to go here. You're going to go there. It's like, are you kidding? You're sending these people all over the world. You're going to Germany. It doesn't work. And so it becomes very difficult to identify these people if they're being deployed individually and coming back to help them make the transition. But if there are units going out, and, you know, the SEAL teams, the special ops teams, they go as a team. They train together, and they pretty much go as a team. And that should be the standard. When you deploy units, they should go as a group, and you could easily follow them, more easily follow them when they make the transition back.
Dr. Bill,
the other part I want to touch on is, Ray and I have had this conversation, and we've all had this, and I know, Dr. Billings, Colonel Billings, you've had this thing too, is for our fathers in World War II, I mean, we got a cut-and-dried enemy, we got a cut-and-dried mission, cut-and-dried everything, clear as a bell, looking at horrific stuff that had to be stopped. We look at Vietnam onward, and partially even Korea, all this stuff is political nonsense. And now the individual goes over the hoo-ha factor, what I'd call as, I can't even describe how to put it in a civilian terms, the hoo-ha factor is there. And so the individual comes back and he's caught in this trap where in order to belong to the group, in order to belong to society, he has to go along with all the stuff. But deep down in his soul, deep down in his heart, deep down inside, all the way to the foundation, he knows this stuff is wrong. And then he tries to justify what we were involved in and what we did and what the outcomes are. And then you look at the overall response and how the veteran is treated and taken care of and the total abandonment of the family. To me, it's just a total friggin' nightmare of all and beyond any comprehension.
Dr.
Billings. We've developed a warrior class. A very, very small percent of our population serves military time. In the past, they all served. There was a draft. Everybody had experience. Everybody shared it. And they weren't criticized for doing it. Now it's become very political. And again, we have a warrior class. These people retire from the military after 20 years. They live usually in a community that's near a base. The integration in our society with our warriors isn't what it used to be. And yeah, I remember, I was in from 68 to 2002, and I remember in the 70s, my experience on the streets of San Francisco when I was in uniform, it wasn't very pleasant. So yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a moral problem. The societal values have changed dramatically. The families changed dramatically. The family structure, the number of divorces in our communities, the number of single parent families. I mean, all of these things, the society has changed, and the military really hasn't really done anything to protect the troops when they depart, when they discharge. It's just like, okay, you're done, you're goodbye. And that has to change. There has to be transitional programs to take all of that into account and how difficult it is getting back into the swing of things and getting back into what they consider as normal for them. So yeah, it's an extremely difficult situation that's not really being dealt with. And people have problems. The way they're raised. The military is a family that they depend on each other to stay alive, and the relationships are. They're meeting their psychological needs more strongly in the military than they could possibly meet them even with their spouses, because they don't depend on their spouse every day to keep them alive. And so their need for love and belonging, that's why a lot of people, you wonder when they come back to this society, they say, I'm going to re-up and I want to go back to combat because I felt better there than I do here. How crazy is that? Somebody feeling better in combat because of the relationships they have with their military families. So, yeah.
Ray and I would both contend, sir, that the warrior class, as you described and as we've encountered, has changed. And these individuals that are being brought into the military now predominantly and getting out now have all of the social, cultural, family problems way beyond the normal thing we saw with the draft. And right. So now when we encounter all this stuff with military and the combat medicine and the PTS and everything else, they don't have the foundation, they don't have the structural strength, they don't have anything to even deal with when they begin with. So the predominant number, the cohort group that are running into problems that can't be dealt with is extraordinarily high in comparison where you had you all come and you all leave together. Does that make sense?
No, that makes a lot of sense. I've experienced it, but I've experienced it in 1968 when I was being trained in Fort Leonard Wood as a combat engineer. I mean, at that time, we had people from Chicago, and it was go to the Army or go to jail. So we had a number of people who did not come from the best families and place in the world. They were criminals, and we had to be very careful. There were a number of homicides on the base while I was there for, 6, 7, 8 months. It was not a good situation. So if that is increased, I mean, it's very difficult. They have to do a better job of screening people before they allow them to serve in our warrior class military. They really have to do a better job. But even when there was a draft, there were a lot of places where go to jail or go to the Army, because they saw back then, they saw the Army, well, this will straighten them out. This will make a man out of them. And you've heard that many times. And sometimes it does. But that's really not the Army's job to make a man out of somebody. The Army's job is to defend the country and not have to waste a bunch of time with people who really aren't prepared and don't have the background to do what needs to be done. Some of these criminals I trained with, they got a lot of people killed in combat. They were just really bad people.
And then you run into the problem with the academics. The individuals that are enlisted today don't have the exact best academic preparation and whole concept and everything. And again, I've been involved in the chemical and the medical area in the military forever and ever and ever, and avionics. The military doesn't really prepare you for a civilian job. I mean, your job is going to military and kill, and that's it. End of story. You fix something.
Well,
the civilian,
you know,
world is totally different, so these guys are coming out in the idea and say, well, they're going to get you a job, come to the military and get you prepared for a job. Then they get out and they find out, what job?
No, they do have, if they use it, the means to identify. Because when I worked at Pendleton, some of the people I worked with were in the alcohol rehab program, and I taught the staff at Pendleton at the hospital in that program how to do psychosocial vocational evaluations on these Marines that were going to be leaving the military. When they were finished with the program, they knew exactly where they were going, how they were going to achieve it. And see, that's what Reboot Program is doing here in San Diego. So there's a thing called transferable skills. I mean, if you train in the military, you know how to follow directions, you know how to take orders, you know how to do certain kinds of jobs. And there's a computer program that you could plug in a military MOS, and it will spit out all the comparable civilian jobs that you would do well in. I mean, it's there, but it's not being used. That's why I said Reboot is a great program, because the first 2 weeks they talk about transition back to the community, what to expect, how to deal with things, how to deal with, you know, family, relationships, people in general. And then they do the job preparation stuff. And, you know, when they leave, I was a guest speaker. They usually do classes for 3 weeks of about 45 people. When I was a guest speaker, every single one of those 45 people would come up and talk about what that program meant to them and what they derived and where they're going. And they knew exactly where they're going. I'm going to go work in my uncle's bakery. I'm going to go and get a bachelor's degree and chemical engineering. I'm going to go. They all said where they were going to go. And San Diego State did follow-up. And guess what? 90-some percent of them were doing exactly what they said they were going to do when they left that program. So the capacity is there to do it. You got to realize when you're in when you get trained, even if it's a rifleman, you have transferable skills that transfer into many jobs, but people don't realize it. And you need to sit down with somebody and show them. And that's not happening.
One thing that I learned everything here in Illinois,
it's happening at Reboot.
One thing I learned here, and it did for me in Illinois, what we do when you were in the military, you came out, you had free schooling. So with all my time in the military, I did the bachelor's, master's, and PhD, and it all came out wonderful.
Exactly.
And everybody in the military has a capability to excel that because they've got that perseverance, they've got that self-discipline.
But you got to give them a direction. If they don't have a direction when they're coming out, you got to do a program like Reboot and say, you know, okay, here's where your skills are. See, we all have different aptitudes and abilities and interests and personalities. And you got to put all that together in a meaningful job. And that's what the California Department of Rehabilitation, like I talked about, the Rehab Act, 1920, that's what they're supposed to do. You take a look. When I was at the medical school at UC Davis, I had a private practice, and it was called Institute for Occupational Services. We took an individual there, let's say who was injured or whatever, and we did physicals, we put them on treadmills, we measured their oxygen intake, CO2 outtake. We did everything, we tested them, and we tied it in to various jobs that they had the ability, aptitude, interest, personality, and physical abilities to handle. And that was in 1970s. So 70s, 80s. I mean, that it's capable even more so now with the computer technology to develop programs like this. So nobody, number one, nobody should be discharged from the military with a label disorder. You keep them until that label is not there. Nobody should be discharged and thrown at the VA, which doesn't really provide the services that they should be providing. You don't discharge somebody with a disorder. And that's why I said in World War II, nobody got discharged with battle fatigue disorder. Nobody.
Because how do they get your book, Doc? We've got a couple minutes left. Let you summarize up and tell them how to contact, get your website and find your book.
Okay, the best way to get the book is go to my book website, and there's a link right to Amazon where you could order the book or order Kindle. And that website's real easy. It's www.bart, B-A-R-T, middle initial P, like Patrick, Billings, B-I-L-L-I-N-G-S.com. www.bartpbillings.com. It'll take you right to the website. There's editorials on the website. There's probably about 15 pages of information. You just click on, you know, about the author, about the book. Over to the right, it says buy book, buy Kindle. And you'll be able to get the book through Amazon. There's print to read where if you're a Prime member of Amazon, it takes you overnight, 2 days. If you're not, it takes you maybe 4 or 5 days. But that's the best way to get it right away.
And when will the next conference come up?
Next conference, it's always in May. And this year's conference is April 29, 30, May 1st. And it's at an integrative wellness center here in San Diego. And that, you know, that, if you want to know about coming to the conference, just click on combatstress.com, and that takes you right to the website.
Well, Colonel Billings, Dr. Billings, we want to thank you again very, very much. Ray, do you have any upcoming things or comments or anything on that you're seeing or that we need to work on?
I'm just still working, the bases and places, churches, everywhere I go. Because like Dr. Billings said, it's not just military. It's everybody who's dealing with trauma. And from the six-year-old kid on up to the 90-year-old, they all need some kind of help. And it's other than drugs. We're trying to get them off those drugs. Colonel Billings, I tell guys to go to their doctors and psychiatrists and tell them they want to get off these psychotropic drugs. And a lot of them are doing that. And anything they can do to back away from this stuff, it'll save their lives.
Well, one of the things, and I'm not saying it, I told people when I wrote the book, people have been asking me for years, the book is about saving lives. I don't care if we generate a penny from the book, but it's about saving lives. And the quote from the parents of a Marine is the first quote in the book, and it says, if we had read your book about the dangers of the drugs that the VA gave our son to treat his PTSD, I'm positive that he would be alive today. The cocktail of drugs given our son killed him. Since his death, we have been on a mission to help other veterans obtain drug-free treatments for PTSD. Dan and Shirley White, Marine Corps parents. And that's what the book is about. So I had a Air Force retiree who was also CIA, who got blown up, brain damage, all kind of problems. And what I did with him a year ago when I started writing the book is I sent him a chapter every week or two. And I said, read the chapter and proof it for me. The 13 chapters.
Thank you, Dr. Billings. The time's up. Thank you, Ray. God bless you. Take care of everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, more information via the Progressive Radio Network, and we're going to get you information from Warrior Connection. God bless you and good night. Thank you, gentlemen.